Because I'm going to talk about sub-band transitions in interacting quantum wires. And these are a number of works with a number of collaborators that I'd like to mention in the beginning. So there's some early works with Anatoly Larkin and Kostya Matveyev, and then some more recent with Markus Garst, Matthias Sitte, Achim Roche, and also Kostya Matveyev. So I want to talk a little bit about what are subbands and the transitions in quantum wires to start with. So a typical experiment with quantum wires is just to measure the conductance as a function of a gate voltage. And what one sees, conductance as a function of gate voltage, is a series of steps. And the plateaus of, or the step heights are given by the conductance quantum, which is, if there's no magnetic field, that's 2E squared over H. If there's a large magnetic field, the step heights go down to E squared over H. So the factor 2 here is due to spin degeneracy. And to understand this picture, it's fairly easy. One can see conductance quantization in a 1D system just by writing the current as the charge density times the velocity with which the charges move. So that would be charge density is electron charge times the density times velocity. Velocity is the Fermi velocity. The density that matters for charge transport is if I have my quantum wire, I have a chemical potential on the left, chemical potential on the right. The difference is the applied voltage, EV. So only the charge carriers within this interval actually contribute to the current. So the density would be given by the width of this interval, which is E times V, times the density of states in that interval. So the particular thing about 1D is that the density of states is proportional to 1 over the Fermi velocity, which means these two Fermi velocities cancel out. I get a current that's E squared over H times V, and therefore a conductance that is just E squared over H. So what this picture corresponds to is a series of independent one-dimensional channels that get filled subsequently, which is easy to understand if I look at a non-interacting electron picture. I have some sort of confining potential in the transverse direction. This confining potential gives me energy levels. What the chemical, what the gate voltage does, it changes the chemical potential. So if the chemical potential is here, I have one filled level that would be the first plateau. If I raise the chemical potential, I go to here, I have two filled levels. These levels are independent. They are independent channels of conductance. So my conductance doubles. So the question is, what happens really at this transition? If how much of this picture remains true if I include interactions into the system? So the two questions is, how independent are these 1D channels really if I have interactions? And what is actually the nature of this transition, which is a quantum phase transition tuned by the applied gate voltage? I am talking about one interacting wire with basically two subbands. Yeah, just one wire. So the two questions are basically how independent are these channels? Independent. And what is the nature of the transition from a one channel to a two channel phase? So in this whatever conductance measurement, there has been considerable attention to what happens on this first subband in relation to this so-called 0.7 structure. But there has very little attention to the transitions and what happens on higher subbands. So we started with the simplest case where we look at spinless electrons or spin polarized electrons. So the model I'm going to look at in order to study these metal transitions is spinless electrons. That interact via Coulomb interaction. And this Coulomb interaction is screened at some large distance. So there's a gate somewhere far away from the wire. D is much, much larger than the typical distance between particles in the wire. And to make that wire, I have some sort of confining potential. The shape of the confining potential doesn't really matter. To get some specific numbers, it's the easiest one one can assume is just a parabolic confining potential. So 1/2 m omega squared y squared. So y is the transverse direction, x would be the direction along the wire. In principle, there's also a c direction. The way these wires are usually made, there's one direction in which the confining potential is much steeper, so it takes much higher energy to excite these transverse modes. So one can forget about those and just look at two-dimensional model to study these transitions. And well, typically, quantum wires aren't infinite. The model I'm looking at is an infinite wire, so the x direction is extended. So if I want to write down the full Hamiltonian for that system, well, I have electrons which have a kinetic energy. Then I have the screened Coulomb interaction. Break over to epsilon, V2R prime. And I won't write the screening for now. It's just that, I mean, the main term is a 1 over R. And we'll keep in mind that it's screened at some long distance. And finally, I have the confining potential. If the interactions are not too strong, meaning the typical interaction energy is not so strong that it mixes up a lot of these subbands, a good starting point is to go to use the subband basis of the non-interacting systems and then study what interactions do to that. So I can diagonalize the transverse degrees of freedom for the non-interacting Hamiltonian consisting just of the kinetic energy and the confining potential, meaning I can write my wave function psi of r as a sum over subband indices n, and I have a wave function that depends on x, and then some transverse from wave function that only depends on y. And so for the main part of the talk, I'll talk about this kind of system where I can use this as a starting point, and we'll concentrate on the case where the chemical potential is somewhere between the second and the third subband. So I have two subbands that contribute to the physics of the system. The rest is high energy and empty. So I concentrate only on one and two subbands. If I have time in the end, I can talk a little bit about what happens if interactions are even stronger and this subband basis is not a good starting point anymore.
Not for single one.
So, well, actually, what I'm most interested in is when the chemical potential, so I have two bands, basically, which are shifted by the level spacing, what happens when the chemical potential is right or near the bottom of the second band. If I have just a single band, this is well studied, nothing new. So what I'm interested in is really what happens if the chemical potential passes just the bottom of the second band. So going into the spaces, my non-interacting Hamiltonian is diagonal. I just get now something that's only a function of x, so sum over n, psi n dagger minus d squared over 2m plus epsilon n, which is the energy of these n, which are these transverse energies. However, since I've diagonalized in the absence of interactions, this thing here will make sub-bands. So the most general form would be really that I get an interaction that depends on basically four indices. N is given by just integrals over these transverse degrees of freedom. So N1, Y, N2. So in principle, I can write down all of these. The question is which ones do actually contribute to the physics of the system. And since I'm interested in the low energy properties, I only have to consider processes that are close to the Fermi energy. So I will have the system where I have two sub-bands. I have my chemical potential, which is somewhere close to the bottom of the second one. So the fact that I'm interested in low-energy physics restricts what momentum transfers are possible. So I only have to worry about interaction processes that involve momenta such that I can stay close to the Fermi energy. Yep. Yep. Yeah. I'm going to talk about it. So for now, I'm starting with a system where I'm not exactly at this limit here. To write down the interaction process, and then we'll see what changes if one actually goes from exactly to that limit. So, well, the first thing is just the intra-subend processes. If I have one subend, if I want to stay close to the Fermi level, I can have either interaction processes now within a single band that involve momenta that are close to zero, that involve momenta that are close to twice the Fermi momentum of that band. And actually what enters, I mean, if I look at the different processes, since I have spinless particles, they're actually indistinguishable. So the coupling constant that really enters is the difference between these two. This is really an exchange process. So if I'm far away from the Fermi level, which I would be in this lower subend, which I call 1, I can, using my long-range Coulomb interaction, which is screened by sine gate, I would get an estimate for that, which is 52 e squared over epsilon log kf1 p over p1, far away from the bottom of the band. Now, if I do the same thing for the upper subband, where I'm getting close to the band, to the bottom, well, then going close to the bottom of the band means taking the limit of kf2 going to 0. And in that limit, the thing vanishes. So if I make an estimate for very small KF2, what I actually get is that the coupling constant for the upper band would be something like E squared over epsilon KF2D squared log 1 over KF2D. So in this upper subband, as I reach the bottom of that band, the interaction becomes weaker and weaker. And at a transition, the system would be non-interacting. And the reason for that is the Pauli exclusion principle. So what happens in this band is that once I decrease the density further and further, eventually the distance between particles actually becomes larger than the distance to the gate, even if the gate is far away. So the interaction becomes effectively local. And since I'm talking about spinless electrons, this local interaction would have no effect. The upper subband becomes non-interacting. One could talk about weakness. Well, the system would be a Wigner crystal in the regime of densities, actually, where I still have long-range Coulomb. So if my density becomes actually, or the typical distance between particles becomes larger than the distance to the gate, I have screening. My interaction isn't 1 over r anymore, and the Wigner crystal wouldn't be there anymore. So there's sort of the Wigner crystal is in the immediate regime of densities. If I have a gate, it doesn't extend all the way of density going to 0. If only this happened, yeah. Yeah, well, we'll look at interactions between the sub and next. I can also talk about, that would be the other limit. If I don't go into this sub-end basis when interactions are strong, my starting point would be to say, well, interactions are strong, I get a Wigner crystal. What is the not strictly one-dimensional case there anymore? So I will talk about that in the end. On the other hand, in a strictly one-dimensional system, there isn't a real difference between a Wigner crystal and a Lattice liquid. So there is no phase transition between the two. So it, in a way, it doesn't matter if I'm talking about a Wigner crystal or non-Wigner crystal, as long as I'm just looking at a single band. Okay. So if I don't talk about interactions between the subbands, I have one subband with interactions where I'm far away from the bottom of the band. So that's what I would usually call a Fermi liquid. I'm far away from the bottom of the band, so I can linearize the spectrum. And that would be my typical one-dimensional system. On the other hand, in this upper band, I'm very close to the bottom of the band. Interactions vanish. In addition, I have interactions between the bands, so I have inter-subband interactions. And there are, again, two different kinds of processes. If I have these two bands, one thing is I can look at interband forward scattering, just the density interaction between the bands, usually corresponding to this kind of process. A particle in the lower band interacts with a particle in the upper band, but they stay in the same band. Again, I have a corresponding exchange process. So the interaction here would be V1122, momentum transfer roughly 0 for this one, and the other one is with a momentum transfer of the order of KF1 plus KF2. And since KF1 is large, I can neglect KF2 here, and I get something very similar. With logarithmic accuracy, this interaction constant corresponding to the interband forward scattering is the same as G1. We'll call this Tx, and it's roughly the same as T1. There's a second kind of processes which remains close to the Fermi level, where I can take two particles in the same band and by the interaction transfer them to the other band. Again, I have an exchange process that comes with it. So here the interaction would be, the one where I have just this. The first one I draw has momentum transfer KF1 minus KF2. The second one has, as this one here, momentum transfer KF1 plus KF2. So we'll see also if I really go to the bottom of this band, the thing will vanish, because it's again a difference that only depends on KF2. If KF2 isn't strictly zero, I get something which is proportional to KF2. I call this process GC. So the question is, how do these processes affect this transition, or what happens to these two subbands? So how to proceed? I have my two subbands. They are coupled by two terms. As I already mentioned, I have one band where I'm far away from the bottom. So it would be a typical one-dimensional system. And what I would usually do there is assume it's a Latentschale liquid, so I can bosonize it. So for subband one, the most convenient description is bosonization. It means I get a Hamiltonian for that subband one, which is V1 over 2 pi. Where theta and phi are conjugate bosonic fields. And the parameter k characterizes the interaction strength. So I have V1, K1 is the Fermi velocity, and K1 depends on this interaction constant G1 in this way. So for subband 2, since I'm interested what happens at the bottom of the band, I can't linearize anymore, because at the bottom of the band, the curvature will be important. So bosonization is not such a good idea. So it's better to just keep the fermionic description for now, which is just and I now include the chemical potential in the description. So this gives me the distance from the bottom of the band. I call this delta mu, which tells me how far away my Fermi level is from the bottom of the second band. So in this mixed language where I have bosons in the lower band and fermions in the upper band, my coupling terms will be mixed terms that couple fermions to bosons. In particular, Hx, which is this density-density interaction, will take this form. Density in a boson language is the derivative of the field phi. For the fermions is just psi dagger psi. Whereas this pair tunneling process, I have to be a little more careful than writing it just this way with the fixed interaction constant. What I actually get is some derivatives of my fermionic field. And then for the psi psi from the other band, it written in terms of bosons, gives me an exponential 2i theta. So I have a mixed model, fermions and boson, coupled by two different interaction terms, which looks fairly messy. It turns out one can actually get rid of one of the interaction terms by applying a unitary transformation that was first done by Balance in 2000. So if I apply a unitary transformation to that system of the following form, G1 squared GX, what that does is it's busy a shift to the density of the bosons. So gradient phi goes to gradient phi plus some contribution of the fermion density. And at the same time, my fermions acquire a phase due to the bosons. So psi goes to e to the minus I over gx over pi gx 1 theta times psi. So I now have pressed particles. I have the fermions, which are the slow degrees of freedom. They get pressed by the fast degree of freedom, which are the plasmons. And some plasmons follow the dynamics of the fermions. So if I look at what all this does to my Hamiltonian, it gets rid completely of the density-density interaction. There is probably some similarity between that, except that you can basically convert electrons, fermions to bosons by this pair tunneling process, which is not the case in the other models, but otherwise it's similar. Yeah. I mean, the difference is the presence of this pair tunneling term, I would think. That's what I was trying to say. The presence of this pair tunneling term, so you can convert fermions to bosons. In a way. The first term. No. I mean, so we have a term in the Hamiltonian that takes two fermions and converts them into a boson. So the Polaron problem, I wouldn't have this pair tunneling term. Otherwise, it's the same. So yeah, what this transformation does, it gets rid of this density-density interaction and I get my dressed fermions for that. And it modifies this pair tunneling term. So what I'm left with is basically Hamiltonians that look as before for subend 1 and subend 2, except it's not the bare bosons and fermions anymore, they're dressed. I got rid of this density-density term, and I get a modified pair tunneling term, which is now... I mean, because the fermions acquire the phase factor, this exponent here changes, and what I get is 2i1 minus this prefactor in the transformation. What would be different is I mean, the main assumption about the ratio KF2 over KF1 was that I have non-interacting particles in the other band. So the interactions terms would also get modified. But if I'm in this limit where KF2 is much smaller than KF1, it doesn't generate an interaction in the second band. If I was far away from the band, I would have interactions in that second band too. So that would be the main difference. And I probably wouldn't want to write it as bosons and fermions. I would just linearize both bands and do two coupled Lattice liquids, which is somewhat simpler. So what one finds is interesting. As long as Gx is small, this term actually wouldn't change the properties of the system at criticality, when I'm really at the bottom of the band. So the transition, I still have my bosons and my fermions. So for Gx small, with interactions. So this, I mean, Gx basically tunes the scaling dimension of this term. So Gx is small at the transition. I don't have to worry about that. I have my Hamiltonian H1, which is a linearized Lattice liquid. So this has a dynamical exponent C equals 1. So it's Lorentz invariant. Whereas my subband H2, if I'm going to the bottom of the band, it's quadratic. So it has a dynamical exponent C equals 2 and Galilean invariant. So if I'm at weak interactions, I have basically the same physics as for the non-interacting system. At criticality, I have two different kinds of dynamics. I have my bosons, which are Lorentz invariant. I have the fermions, which are Galilean invariant. So it's the same kind of transition as for the non-interacting system. It turns out, however, that this pair tunneling changes what happens if I'm slightly above the transition. So the properties at criticality are the same as for the non-interacting system. But if I'm talking about non-interacting particles, as I have my chemical potential within the second band, I have two independent channels. It turns out that this is not true anymore, even at weak interactions. Conductivity is tricky for one-dimensional systems because
so the story is about the right, right?
Yeah.
Now the right. So this is on now. Everybody gets to the goal. What is going on now?
So actually what I'll claim is that the conductance plateau transition isn't necessarily related to this transition I'm talking about. Because actually what happens is I have this transition. I'm now in a model, in a phase where I have these two bands, but these two bands are coupled. And what this coupling leads to is actually that I only have one gapless excitation in the system. The other mode gets gapped out by the interactions. And at least within, I mean, that remains to be seen, but we haven't done a calculation of conductance yet. But basically, at least the naive picture is for each gapless excitation, you get the conductance quantum. So now you acquire a second mode, but it's gapped. So actually, the conductance, at least the zero temperature conductance, wouldn't change. It only changes once you actually decouple these two excitations and the gap in the second one disappears. So, I mean, this is about spinless particles, so it would be E squared over H and 2 e squared over h. So what I'm saying is that what this would suggest is that I have my transition where the second subband actually gets occupied somewhere here, and then the conductance transition, where I have this plateau transition, happens at a later point where these two channels actually become independent. Well, actually, we looked at some case before. So, I mean, we're looking really at the second transition, not at the first one. So the important thing is that we have two bands, whereas the 0.7 is strongest in the limit where you only have one band. Something I didn't want to talk about it. I mean, they see a weak feature of a weaker 0.7 structure also on higher plateaus. No.
Okay, what are you aiming at?
To study interesting physics of these subbands transitions. I mean, in the beginning, we did, well, one motivation was the 0.7 anomaly, which shows that, I mean, what is believed to be a fairly simple system is still not completely understood. So there are interesting interaction effects. We study one interesting interaction effect, which is not the one most people seem to study and still don't have a conclusion on. But that would be something interesting to look at the transition to a higher band. Yeah, to get its polarized one, we need strong fields. The other thing is, I mean, interaction strength is basically tuned by density. So at the beginning of the first plateau, density is low. That's why interactions should be important, and that's probably somehow related to the 0.7 anomaly. At the first step, not that I know. I mean, the main thing they said is that the 0.7 evolves smoothly to the half plateau if you apply high fields. But yeah, that's the full plateau. So what I'm trying to say is that to see interaction effects, one wants to be in a low density regime. So at the onset of the first step, that's a given. I mean, you go from zero density to some finite density. If you want to have low density at a subsequent step, that's already more difficult. So what one really wants is to have a very shallow confining potential to have a transition to the next level already at low densities. And I don't think experiments yet are necessary in the regime where one expects strong interaction effects at the second step. So if they haven't seen anything yet, that might be one explanation. So currently, Mike Pepper's group, they are trying to make wider wires and or a more shallow confining potential and see how that affects can. As far as conductance, it would definitely affect the temperature dependence. I mean, because you have a gap that evolves somehow with density, so you would see it in the temperature dependence. We haven't computed conductance yet. We're studying the transition. We are speculating how that would affect the conductance. Okay, so what I was saying here is that the transition itself, at weak interactions, the nature of the transition isn't changed. What happens, which one can show if one is a little bit above the transition, since interactions in the second band vanish, as long as I'm not exactly at a transition point, I can actually linearize. So if I do RG with a linearized spectrum, I find that the coupling due to this term between the two modes actually leads to a gap. So I have two modes, only one. I mean, I get a second mode as I fill the second band, but I have only one gapless excitation. And the new mode that appears has a gap that's proportional to the distance from the transition to some exponent alpha, where at weak interactions alpha is very large. So the main thing that I actually wanted to talk about is what happens at strong interactions. What happens at strong interactions is that this thing that I call kappa goes to zero if I send my interaction strength to infinity. So that means if I'm at infinite interactions, I get a decoupling between my bosons and the fermions. So this was the only remaining coupling term. The exponent goes to zero. So I only have these Psi-Dagger terms here. So in the limit of strong interactions, the decoupling of bosons and fermions, so if my interactions are truly infinite, the two subband model would not be justified. I would involve higher subbands. It turns out that one can actually come to exactly the same model starting from the strongly interacting case. So assuming that interactions dominate the physics, so then my ground state would be a Wigner crystal. At some critical density, this would split into a two-row crystal, creating a zigzag. And then if I look at excitations in the two-row crystal, I arrive at exactly the same model. I have my bosons are the plasmon in this crystal, and I have some transverse excitation, which is described basically by the same Hamiltonian I get from here. So even though in this model this limit isn't strictly justified, it leads to the same model I would get with something that's more justified in the strong interacting limit. So I get a decoupling of bosons and fermions. The bosons are just the plasmon excitation, nothing unusual there. But the fermions are quite different of the bare fermions I had at weak interactions. These fermions, well, they have now this interaction term here. So the corresponding Hamiltonian actually describes an Ising model. So the transition at strong interactions is of Ising type. So fermions, these are Ising fermions. I get a transition which then has a gap which is proportional to the distance from the transition, typical linear Ising relation. And the other thing that's very different is, well, what this corresponds to is a dynamical exponent of 1. So I have a change from my Galilean invariant system at weak interactions to now at strong interactions, again, bosons and fermions, but now these fermions have actually are Lorentz invariant. In the Wigner crystal, So in a Wigner crystal, if I just look at, well, this structure here, I would, there's four different excitations I can look at naively. I have a longitudinal in-phase motion of the two rows, which is my plasmon. I have an out-of-phase motion longitudinal of the two rows, which costs a large energy due to interactions. And then I have two transverse excitations. Again, the in-phase one would cost large energy because of the confining potential. And then I have sort of a staggered transverse mode. So if I write down a theory for this staggered mode by just assuming, well, this is the ground state configuration, so I look at fluctuations on top of that, I get exactly the same Ising fermions. So I would write, well, I would introduce a variable phi, which is basically the staggered displacement along the y direction. If I develop into, well, small deviations phi, I get a phi to the fourth theory, where the transition is characterized where the coefficient of the phi squared term changes sign. That's what gives me the transition from a one row to this two row Wigner crystal. And this phi to the fourth theory can be mapped on a spin chain and then by Jordan-Wigner transformation on these Ising fermions. So yeah, there is a clear model for that within the Wigner crystal. So actually what I wanted to talk about, and now it's already quite late, is what happens if I'm at strong interactions, but not quite in that limit yet. So kappa is not zero. I'm at strong interactions, but there's still some residual coupling between the bosons and the fermions. And unfortunately, I erased that. But rather than treating this term where the coupling is in the pair tunneling term, it's easier to treat a residual density-density interaction. So I can do my unitary transformation, but now that in such a way that my pair tunneling term disappears, well, not disappears, but that the exponent goes to zero, the price I have to pay is I keep some residual density-density interaction. So what I want to look at is a model where I have my bosons, I have my Ising fermions, and they're coupled by a small density-density interaction. So that's at fairly strong interaction, but not in the limit. I'm coupled to zero. What one finds that, I mean, as I said before, these two would be Lorentz invariant separately, but this term here breaks Lorentz invariance. So what we looked at is how does this term change the nature of the transition, and the way we looked at it is in perturbative RG. So what one needs to do is basically renormalize both the velocities of these two modes, the bosons and the fermions, and the coupling constant lambda. One can choose RG conditions such that the boson velocity is fixed. Everything depends on the ratio of velocities. So one more thing about the Ising fermions. The full Hamiltonian for the fermions was this psi dagger minus d squared over 2m plus delta mu psi. And then I had this psi dagger, d psi dagger terms. So at the transition, this term will be more relevant than the quadratic term. So I can actually forget about this quadratic term. I have only to keep this linear term. So the coefficient here, which used to be this gamma, is basically the velocity of my fermion excitations. So I have to whatever compute the boson self-energy, fermion self-energy, so the dashed lines are bosons, the full lines are fermions, and the vertex correction. And what I find is that, so at the transition when delta mu is zero, I get two equations for u prime, and I won't write them down there in the paper, and for lambda prime. And for the moment, I'm keeping v fixed. So what I'm really looking at is ratios u over v and lambda over v. So rather than the equations, I'll just show the flow diagram. The flow diagram, the function of u over v and lambda over v, I get within this lowest order one loop RT, I get a line of fixed points when the velocities are equal. This line of fixed point is characterized by an anomalous dynamical exponent. So C is not 1 like it, at the fixed point, but it's 1 plus lambda squared k over 4 pi squared uv, so it's slightly larger than 1 for finite lambda. If I'm above this line, the flow is towards strong coupling, lambda flows to infinity. If I'm below this line, lambda flows to 0, and the velocities approach each other. So here, lambda to infinity, lambda to 0, and at the same time, u approaches v. So the fixed point of the theory is where lambda goes to 0, so the non-interacting fixed point with equal velocity, which is, so the fixed point is Lorentz invariant, my critical exponent is 1, and I have this additional symmetry because the velocities become all equal. So I have a fixed point which can be described as these three Majorana fermions with all the same velocities. So the fixed point has SU2 invariance due to that and this Lorentz invariance. That's part of it. Now, the interesting thing is, if I actually look at how the flow towards this fixed point happens a little more closely, what I notice is that this is not the only thing that happens. So the velocities approach, but at the same time, actually both the velocities scale to 0. So I can write, if the physical velocities, or which are really the velocities of this excitations, is not what I called v here, but I have physical velocity, which depends on the scaling of this critical exponent. And what happens that in the limit where B is going to infinity. B is my is the renormalization factor of the cutoff. That's the way I'm changing my cutoff from lambda over B during RG. So as B goes to infinity, cutoff goes to zero, this thing vanishes. So even though I have a nice fixed point theory with equal velocities, these velocities actually vanish. So in any real system, I have some residual breaking of Lorentz invariance due to this coupling, which makes that the velocities scale to zero, and the physics is not completely described by the fixed point, but the scaling towards that fixed point is actually very important. There are other examples for that. In graphene with long-range Coulomb interaction, something similar was found, except that it went in the opposite direction. So, well, what happens here depends on the sign 1 minus c. So if I have a nanolumens exponent that's smaller than 1, I get an opposite sign, which makes gamma b actually go to infinity. This means, in that case, velocities would actually diverge rather than go to zero. And one of the consequences is, well, for example, if the velocities go to zero, that means that the specific heat coefficients would vanish, which is proportional to one over the velocities. And I would think that this is something that's actually more general than that. I mean, there's two examples, the one we looked at and graphene, but the fact that the properties of the system are actually also governed by the flow towards the fixed point is probably not just specific to these examples. I think I'll just stop here. Yes. I mean, of what I told you last about one one consequence would be the divergence of the specific heat coefficient as temperature goes to zero. Gedanken experiment. Divergence. The coefficient diverges. The gamma coefficient, so C over T diverges. Huh? Yeah, at the corner of the curve. The quantum critical point is where the chemical potential is exactly at the bottom of the upper band. Yeah. So if when it had non-interacting, the divergence would be just from the upper band.
Yeah.
Now it's some combination of the two bands. So yeah, the divergence here is, okay, I have it down. It's this is a very interesting divergence. Yeah. So yeah, if one wants to basically probe the properties of what happens if one is within the second mode, then the important thing is that one gets a gap in one of the excitations. So while conductance might not be the best way to probe this, one thing that definitely would affect is tunneling density of states. So if I have a one-dimensional system, I mean, the easiest to visualize this is, again, in the Wigner crystal. If I have a one-dimensional system, I want to put an additional particle. I have to excite the plasmon, which leads to a suppression of the density of states, but it doesn't have a hard gap. On the other hand, if I want to tunnel into a zigzag structure, still I have to excite the plasmon. I have to make space. But even if I do that, well, this particle will go into one of the rows, which creates a defect. This defect has a finite energy, which would lead to a gap. So that would be another manifestation.
You don't want
for a spin gap in a way. So you, it means that basically, I mean, you have two excitations. They are more or less decoupled, but bare electrons are always a superposition of the two. So in that way, it's similar. Yeah, that would be a hard gap. Yeah. You mean there's a hard gap, and then what's the behavior above the gap? I mean, you still have, basically you excite the plasmon, so you move everything else out of the way. So you get your power law suppression due to exciting the plasmon, but in addition, you pay the price of the domain wall. I mean, you don't have to rearrange everything. You just, well, you cut your crystal and shift the two sides the way you do it in a single row. So in the Wigner crystal, it's not clear. It seems, I mean, if one does it classically, no, there's no decoupling of the modes. If one looks at what happens at weak interactions, one finds that actually at a fairly low density in the second mode, the two modes would decouple and one would get two independent excitations. Haven't studied it yet. Yeah. That should be interesting.